loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about the latest breaking news regarding so-called Russiagate and Russia's alleged interference in the United States. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, surrendered to the FBI and is pleading guilty to multiple charges. Two congressional hearings are taking up new punishing sanctions against Russia. And the UK's foreign minister is insisting that the entire EU, which Britain is leaving, join in new sanctions on Russia. We'll unpack that and more in the first half hour. And then we continue our weekly series. It happens every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Russia's foreign minister said today that the Taliban have accepted an invitation to attend talks on the future of Afghanistan to be held in Moscow on September 4th. Sergei Lavrov said that the aim of the talks is to encourage the Taliban to abandon hostilities, to engage in a dialogue with the Afghan government, and to protect Russian citizens in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, hopes for a temporary halt in the fighting have broken down following a mass kidnapping and a rocket attack on the presidential palace as President Ashraf Ghani was giving a speech. Next, Mumia Abu-Jamal has been in prison in Pennsylvania since 1981 after being accused and convicted of killing a policeman. He was on death row until 2011 when his sentence was converted to life without parole. Mumia and his supporters have always maintained his innocence, and he will be in court again next week in Philadelphia. He'll be in court on August the 30th, pursuing a new legal strategy that argues that Ronald Castile, a former district attorney whose office prosecuted the case, was improperly involved in his appeal after he became a state Supreme Court justice. Then American prisoners are going on strike today all across the country. The action will continue through September 9th, which marks the anniversary of the deadly uprising at the Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York. But the strike isn't necessarily political in nature. Prisoners want to draw attention to prison conditions and exploitative labor practices, and they want their work to be valued by society. And then today marks the 47th anniversary of the death of George Jackson. We take a look at his legacy and present-day significance. And finally, voting rights activists in Georgia are decrying a state plan to close two-thirds of the polling stations in a predominantly black county. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a formal protest with the county's electoral board. Even the Republican nominee for governor has urged officials to abandon the plan. And in other headlines, protesters in North Carolina toppled a controversial statue of a Confederate soldier last night. The statue was located at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and known as Silent Sam. For over a year, there has been renewed attention throughout the country over the issue of public statues that honor the racist legacy of the pro-slavery Confederacy. Iran revealed a new fighter jet the government says was designed and manufactured entirely inside the country. The fourth-generation fighter is called the Kausar, and its unveiling was attended by President Hassan Rouhani. The Iranian government has as a top priority the development of domestic industry and defense capability in order to withstand new sanctions and an intensified regime change push by the Trump administration. The Environmental Protection Agency announced that it was repealing the Obama-era Clean Power Plan in line with the Trump administration's pro-coal policies. In its place, the EPA has announced what it calls the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, which allows individual states to make their own policies regarding the use of fuels that emit greenhouse gases that cause climate change. Critics argue that the additional pollutants that could be emitted as a consequence of the rollback of the Clean Power Plan will lead to at least 1,400 premature deaths every year. President Trump has waded into the contested Wyoming Republican gubernatorial primary, endorsing Foster Friess. Friess is a prominent conservative mega donor and wealthy investment manager. Friess's two main opponents are Mark Gordon and Sam Galliotos. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the latest developments in so-called Russiagate. Key Senate committees held hearings today and news that Microsoft has seized six websites that it says were registered by Russia's military intelligence organization, the GRU, and that targeted Republican think tanks and the U.S. Senate. New U.S. sanctions on Russia take effect tomorrow, and two senators are sponsoring what they are calling the sanctions bill from hell that they would pass if U.S. intelligence agencies confirm that the Russian government was behind the six suspended websites. Meanwhile, British Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt today called on all EU member countries to join the United States and UK sanctions. We're joined in studio by Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry. And he's the author of the book, How I Lost, by Hillary Clinton. And from London, by Alexander McCuris, he is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander and Joe, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Brian.
Great to be here.
Alexander, since you are in London, I'm just confused. I thought Britain was leaving the EU, and now its foreign minister, Jeremy Hunt, has insisted that all EU countries join together with Donald Trump and Theresa May to carry out new crushing sanctions on Russia. I mean, how are the other EU countries taking that?
I don't think they're going to take it very well at all. We've just had an important summit meeting between Vladimir Putin and Angela Merkel in Germany, where Merkel invited Putin for the first time since the 2014 Ukrainian crisis for a bilateral summit. We've seen a government in Italy recently elected, which is favorable to Russia. We've seen President Macron attend the SPIEF, the St. Petersburg Economic Forum in Russia a few months ago. And of course, we've seen Vladimir Putin dancing with the Austrian foreign minister. So I can't really imagine that there's going to be much enthusiasm in Europe for further sanctions campaign against Russia. And I think that has to be the reality of it. So I think Jeremy Hunt can talk as much as he likes. I think this is partly connected with British internal politics, but I don't really foresee a huge move for more sanctions against Russia and Europe.
Joe Loria, news is kind of breaking fast. We had Jeremy Hunt's speech, which I want to come back to, but the news that just broke this afternoon that Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, has surrendered to the FBI and is facing 3 to 4 years in jail as part of a plea deal, sources told CNN. That's just this afternoon. That's just breaking news. President Trump's former personal attorney could be facing more than 4 years behind bars. Again, we don't know the details of the possible charges or the possible deal, but according to CNN in their newsroom Twitter, it says, breaking, Michael Cohen is expected to plead guilty to multiple counts of campaign finance violations, tax fraud, and bank fraud. Joe, what does that have to do with Russia or the allegations of meddling by Russia in the 2016 election?
Well, you just stole my thunder there, because I was going to answer your question with a question. What the hell does this have to do with Russia?
Yeah.
It has to do with paying off porn stars or taxi medallions, or same as the Manafort trial.
Yeah.
About corrupt, these guys are corrupt, fine. I mean, and Trump might be corrupt, probably was, and they might find that out. But what does this have to do with Russia, Russiagate, Russian collusion, the Trump people colluding with Russia to steal the election? Zero. That's zero to do with that. And yet, you know, this is drummed up and mixed in all together to try to give more substance to the argument why we need more sanctions. And to follow on what Alexander said, isn't how convenient is it that neither the U.S. nor Britain have the kind of trade with Russia that Germany has, for example, nowhere near as much. So they're asking Germany to be hurt by this for their own political, geopolitical aims. That's what that's
which makes
about.
No sense at all. Makes no sense at all.
For them.
But
for
the
them.
Germans
yeah,
keep
exactly.
going along with it. Why did the Germans yeah. hurt their own self-interest?
I don't know. It
German
doesn't make
business
any sense.
Is not happy with these sanctions at all. They haven't been from the beginning.
That's right.
And yet Merkel goes along. It could only be because the NSA is listening into her. And she is a pawn of the U.S.
Yeah. What's your take on that, Alexander? Why does Germany keep going along? I mean, we have this trade war and sanctions, and you look at the whole thing put together, it looks like just a grand scheme for American protectionism so that American companies get better deals at the expense of European interests who could be buying stuff from Russia, like energy sources through Nord Stream 2. and instead buying energy from faraway places like the United States. I mean, why is Germany and why is Europe going along? Do they believe that Russia's on the march, that this is the Russians have to be punished because of meddling or the Skripals or whatever?
Well, I think, first of all, if I can just talk about Germany, I mean, the thing to understand about Germany is that Germany has for decades been anchored in the NATO alliance and has defined its foreign policy and developed its domestic policy very much around the Atlantic Lake, which was for the Germans the passport to escaping from the situation that they were in after the Second World War, where they weren't just the defeated power, but the pariah power in Europe. Now, I think this is changing. I mean, I've just seen an opinion poll which shows that Angela Merkel, who continues for many Germans now to embody this policy, her Christian Democratic Union, CSU, CDU party, is now fallen to 28% of the vote, which is the lowest vote it had ever had since it was formed in the 1940s. Its coalition partner, the SPD, the other dominant party historically Germany, is now at 16.5%. Again, a critical low. So I think German opinion is shifting, and it is shifting for precisely the reasons that you said, which is that they are being asked repeatedly now since 2014 to follow what is a policy that is more in the interest of the United States than it is of Germany itself. And I think we're starting to see a resistance to this growing in Germany, and before long, I suspect it will acquire critical mass. As for Europe, one has to understand that Europe is a geographical expression. There are many different countries in Europe with different policies. So, I mean, you have a country like Italy or a country like Austria or a country like Hungary with very good relations with Russia. You have countries like Poland and the Baltic states and Romania with very bad relations with Russia. Britain, as you correctly said at the start of the program, is leaving the European Union, but it is still a member of NATO, and it is still culturally and geographically a part of Europe. It too has very bad relations with Russia. So there are conflicts within Europe, but the dominant powers, the powers that really matter, which are going to be still there when Brexit takes place, Germany, Italy, and France, they are increasingly showing impatience with this very strong anti-Russian policy that's been coming out of Washington, and they've been moving to mend their relations with Russia. And I suspect that the pressures from the United States are, in the end, somewhat against their wishes, going to force these countries to pursue that policy of rapprochement with Russia even more aggressively.
Joe Loria, let me turn to you to ask you about this Microsoft story. Microsoft is saying that their own internal security stopped a Fancy Bears, that is a Russian government hacking operation, on two conservative and Republican think tanks. Now, certain conspiracies emerge quickly in my mind. And since everything right now is at the realm of conspiracy because there's no actual hard evidence, it's hard not to go there. But I'm looking at the headline, CNN, Russians targeted Senate and conservative think tanks, Microsoft says. Now, this is the Hudson Institute and the Republican Institute. Now, the question in my mind is, given the extreme scrutiny that Russia is under about the issue of hacking, and given the fact that Donald Trump's Republican Party would be the entity that would more or less say, well, no, this is a democratically led, politically motivated attack against Donald Trump. And they've been arguing the point that Donald Trump is the president because of the Russian interference, that his election is invalid. Why would the Russians then go and attack Republican think tanks, which would, of course, only alienate Republicans who might be the supporters of Donald Trump? So, like, what would be the big benefit to Russian intelligence to break into the Hudson Institute, for instance?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that the story has confirmed that it was Russia, has it?
Well, that's the thing. Is
most of these stories?
That's what they're saying. Yeah,
yeah. Most of these stories have this paragraph, like 20, yeah. paragraph 29, that says we cannot confirm that it was right.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, I think there is a bipartisan establishment anti-Russian view, including the Republicans. And I don't just mean John McCain.
Yeah,
I think this goes for the longer view of this whole so-called scandal, which encompasses the geopolitical strategy the United States has had, and Britain has played a big role in, against Russia, to try to stop Putin from being the obstacle to their geopolitical interests. And I think that Russiagate fit right into that, and especially with the intelligence agencies. For the Democrats, it was more a political issue. They lost the election. But there were some people in the intelligence community here in the United States, like Morrell and Brennan, who expected to get jobs maybe with the Clinton administration. So they're pissed off about that personally for their careers, and that's why they're blaming Russia. But from the establishment point of view, the big crises we're having in democracy in the U.S. and in Europe that was expressed in the 2016 election, particularly in the U.S., when we saw insurgencies on the right and the left, we see that 30 years after these neoliberal economic policies, the people are figuring it out and starting to get really ticked off about that. So longstanding divisions like racial divisions in the U.S. and the growing economic divide have nothing to do with Russia. But it's very convenient, clearly, to blame Russia for those problems, for undermining our democracy, when it's the plutocrats who have undermined our electoral system with their donations and their buying of our electoral system. But they can't obviously admit that. And then you've got the media, the corporate media, of course, doing their bidding. And I'll give you an example in this very story that you're talking about, Brian. The New York Times, David Sanger and Shira Frankel, their lead is the Russian military intelligence unit that sought to influence the 2016 election appears to have a new target. These are public. Now, this is the New York Times trying and convicting Russian agents in the press. Why do we need courts when we have newspapers? We don't need the courts. The newspapers are trying these people. This is so typical where there's a lack of due process, not only in government, in Britain, and in the U.S. in particular, on foreign policy issues and then the Russia issue. Russia did Skripal. That's why we need these new sanctions. Russia, it took over the election. Now, the government could say that, but the media's job is to say, wait a minute, prove that.
Yeah, exactly. And they're not doing that.
And they go right along. So I'm much angrier as being a journalist myself and having worked in corporate media for 30 years with the corporate media than I am with the government, who I expect to lie. I don't expect the press to go along with it and try these people in their pages of the New York Times.
Yeah.
And now and Alexander hears from the New York Times, facing new Russian hackings, again, unproved, facing new Russian hackings, senators signaled they are ready to act. And I want to read a couple of sentences to you. Faced with new evidence, again, this is not new evidence. This is allegations. Faced with new evidence that Russian hackers are targeting conservative American research groups and the Senate's own web pages, key lawmakers from both parties signaled on Tuesday that they were ready to move forward with punishing new sanctions legislation capable of crippling the Russian economy. Now, before you respond, Alexander and John, I know you want to jump in. Didn't John Brennan hack into the U.S. Senate committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee?
Lie about
Indeed
it.
And
he
then
did
the torture report. I mean, the CIA carried out covert operations against its own oversight committee. And here we are. These senators have leapt into actions for new punishing sanctions.
I just wanted to add, too, to that this new sanctions bill that's being considered is being called by its authors the sanctions bill from hell, meaning this will be the worst, the heaviest sanctions ever to have been placed on the Russians.
And now liberals can follow Marco Rubio, one of the big architects, ultra-rightist Marco Rubio. I mean, anyway, Alexander, go ahead.
Yes, I mean, I think it comes back to the point that Joe was saying, that this is very much the agenda anyway. I mean, these people loathe Russia. They have a very clear geopolitical objective about Russia. So they're seizing on this story of fancy bear hacks and things of this kind, which could be Russia, it could be Russians, it could be anybody. But they're not interested in the evidence, because what they want is the sanctions. They want a total cutoff of any kind of economic relations between the United States and Russia, and they want to tie Donald Trump's hands because they suspect him. Well, they don't. I mean, it's not a question of suspicion. Donald Trump has signaled that he wants better relations with Russia, and these people want to make that impossible. So they're pushing relentlessly this whole sanctions agenda for that purpose. And when I say some Republicans want to do it, of course there are some Republicans in the Senate especially who do not like Donald Trump, not because they necessarily disagree with him on all sorts of domestic political issues, but because there are certain personality issues and quarrels that go back to the 2016 election, which he won against their wishes. So you have this agenda that is being followed, and now we have the pretext. And indeed, I have to say, and I'm not usually a conspiratorially minded person, but isn't it convenient that these alleged hacks of these conservative Republican institutions are supposed to have come along at exactly this time when the sanctions bill was already being talked about? Well, I mean, I don't know. It does seem to be remarkably convenient for some people.
Yeah, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to – that's absolutely right. The vote's coming up. You need Republican votes. But I did want to answer your previous question. And Alexander just mentioned it could have been Russia. Yes, it could have been Russia. I mean, everyone is spying on one another. This is a given. They're hacking – the United States, the largest of them all, obviously, in cyber operations offensively. But why would Russia do this? And why would they want to know what the U.S. is planning, thinking, what their policies making, what the think tanks are formulating? It's defensive, in my view, and this is the key issue. The United States is the aggressor in this story, and that is not understood clearly by the American people because the corporate media pushes, as Jeremy Hunt said it today in his speech, that Russia is up to all no good all over the world. Well, it's defending us from attacks from jihadists in Syria. That's why they went into Syria. Assad, who was no great Democrat, was never a threat to the West or even to Israel, but the jihadists were. That's why Russia went in. And Russia doesn't have bases all over the world like the United States does, etc. So if you see it from Russia's point of view, they are trying to defend themselves from NATO troops up against their border, etc. There's so many valid evidence to show that Russia is on the defensive in this relationship. So yes, they're trying to get some information maybe to help themselves in that regard. That's what I think. If, in fact, they did it, and we'd never know these things.
Well, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal article from an earlier story today, and I think this is also important. Here's the headline. Get both of your reactions. Trump, seeking to relax rules on U.S. cyber attacks, reverses Obama directive. Administration has faced pressure to show that it is taking seriously national security cyber threats. President Trump has reversed an Obama-era memorandum dictating how and when the U.S. government can deploy cyber weapons against its adversaries in an effort to loosen restrictions on such operations, according to people familiar with the action. Trump signed an order on Wednesday reversing the classified rules known as Presidential Policy Directive 20 that had mapped out an elaborate interagency process that must be followed before U.S. use of cyber attacks, particularly those geared at foreign adversaries. Now, that's a pretty important announcement because there were a lot of cyber attacks under Obama and sure, going on. They were directed against Iran and against others.
Trump wants to make it easier, is what you're
Trump
saying.
Wants to make it easier, but you know that might be a reason progressive people or liberal people might attack Donald Trump. But under this environment, just the opposite will be happening because the entire rationale and justification now exists for the U.S. to quickly morph over into relaxing rules that allow the U.S. to carry out aggressive, that is, offensive cyber weapons attacks. In other words, we have inaugurated a new era. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, I think the other thing is that when one hears about relaxing controls, does that mean a weakening of political controls? Does that mean that decisions of this kind are not going to be made by elected people like the President of the United States and the people around him? Does it mean that it's going to be made by the intelligence agencies themselves? You see, this is the problem. One never really knows how these decisions are made. And of course, if we're going to get into a situation where people lower down the structures are in a position to make these sort of decisions by themselves without proper political supervision, and given how dangerous cyber attacks are, that it is an extremely dangerous situation indeed, because cyber attacks, some people have talked about them as being potentially a new arms race alongside the nuclear arms race that is already underway. And I have to say, when I hear these things about relaxing controls over the use of these weapons, it fills me with foreboding.
Yeah, it does. And it may mean what you're suggesting, Alexander, that it means lower level officials or people within the state, even commanding officers in the field, have capacity to carry out offensive cyber weapons attacks. Or Donald Trump could just be aggregating for his own executive authority the right to, without much review, carry out cyber weapons attack. We know he would certainly want to do that on Iran. He would certainly want to do that on behalf of Saudi Arabia or Israel. We just don't know where it goes, except we do know it's a license for more war. Joe Laurie, I'm looking at Politico right now. Here's the headline. I just hacked a state election. I'm 17, and I'm not even a very good hacker. It took a lot less than you'd think for myself and my fellow teens to steal the midterms. A couple of quick sentences. It took me around 10 minutes to crash the upcoming midterm elections. Once I accessed the shockingly simple and vulnerable set of tables that make up the state's election board database, I was able to shut down the website that would tally the votes, bringing the election to a screeching halt. The data were lost completely, and just like that, tens of thousands of votes vanished into thin air. I'm 17, and I'm not even a good hacker. That's in Politico right now.
But like Trump said, could it be a 300-pounder sitting in the basement who did it, right?
Of his parents' apartment.
So, in this evidence-free environment in which we're operating, that doesn't matter. It just has to be Russia, and we don't have to prove it. The press doesn't demand the evidence, so you don't have to prove it. And this is what we have. And now you have to point out also that Obama, just before he left office in a press conference about this whole Russia issue and hacking, said that they did not hack into the election machines. Rosenstein repeated that again in the last indictment of the GRU agents. They didn't hack into the election machines. And also, if you look at that indictment of the GRU agents, there's no law mentioned that was broken about the electoral law. It's only cyber laws that were broken. They never charged him with laws under the election laws that we have in the U.S. on the books. So they were never really charging them with interfering with the election at all. So what does this mean? It means 300-pounder may have done it.
Yeah, and here we're going to have this the Senate and House committees. We're going to have the media already indicting Russia for the hack. Microsoft said it. I'm reading media accounts. It's not even like alleged. The word alleged does not even appear. New crippling, punishing sanctions. I mean, also, just a reminder to everybody, sanctions are an attempt to use food and medicine and the things people need to sustain life as weapons. It's a weapon of war. So it might sound like, oh, we're going to employ sanctions against Russia, Joe Lauria. But actually, it's not Vladimir Putin. It's Russian people who are being, they want to make Russian people suffer with the hope that eventually, I guess, they'll overthrow their government.
Well, in the immortal words of Madeleine Albright, it was worth it.
Yeah.
When she was asked whether the sanctions against Iraq in the 90s got killed maybe as much as 500,000 children.
And she was asked directly, if 500,000 kids died because of Iraq sanctions, were worth it? And she, Madeleine Albright, then said, wow, that's a tough question, but yes, it was worth it. Killing 500,000 kids? I mean, how do you even bring yourself to say killing 500,000 kids is worth it? Because
this is the sociopathic mindset of the rulers of the United States and other countries, but in the U.S., and that's why they can do what they're going to do.
Alexander Mercuris, 10 seconds. You get the last 10-second words.
Well, very simply, I mean, I agree with all of that. I would also add that these sanctions are going to fail. I mean, one of the reasons we are seeing more and more sanctions is that none of the sanctions that have been imposed succeed. So what do? You double down. You demand more sanctions all the time, partly to enact your own.
We're going to leave it right there. That's Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. We were also joined in studio by Joe Lauria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry. He's the author of the book, How I Lost, by Hillary Clinton. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear. You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Today, we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel talks to us from San Francisco every week, every Tuesday. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
A lot of big issues. I mean, I was looking, as I do every morning, at the Wall Street Journal. The Trump administration obviously has a split personality, so to speak, on what to do about China. We're going to get into what's coming next with the U.S.-China trade policies. But let's start with something that, I don't know, it's more mundane. Amazon isn't paying its electric bills?
Yeah, this was one I wanted to bring up because I thought it was pretty worthwhile. Basically, in Bloomberg, they reported on Amazon, which is, because it dominates such a huge part of the energy market, is essentially shifting costs from itself onto day-to-day people in the communities that it purchases energy from. So just to kind of break it down, Amazon Web Services, which is a service that stores data, basically it's a cloud data storage service, is one of the biggest in the world, and it uses about 2% of the energy produced in the United States, which is a massive amount of energy. And because it has such outsized monopoly kind of power, it can really go into different areas and negotiate its own prices. And if it doesn't like the prices that the state or the private energy companies are providing, it can just go elsewhere. And so it has tremendous oversized muscle. So what's happening is a lot of local politicians are handing out huge tax credits to Amazon with the hopes that they'll build data centers in their region under the guise that these data centers will create jobs. But the truth is data centers create minimal amounts of jobs. It's like roughly 50 people per data center, which is tiny. And then the private companies who it will purchase energy from all compete with one another, give Amazon huge discounts, and then shift the cost of those discounts onto the non-millionaire users. So it's talking, you know, specifically about this woman in Virginia who's seeing her, you know, energy bill balloon 130% or something like that because Amazon moved into her area, got a huge sweetheart deal, and they're just pushing that onto them. So whether it's, you know, pushing the cost onto the taxpayers through these tax subsidies, which is just a fancy way of saying making working taxpayers pay for you, right? Subsidies, that's all it is. And also making working people who purchase the energy from the companies also pay an extra tax or fee, if you will, to cover the loss that they've received because they've given Amazon such a huge deal. So it's really interesting because I think there is this, you know, popular narrative in our society that the kind of, you know, kings of capital got there because they were smart and innovative and the state just holds back innovation and causes problems and it just needs to get out of the way and let capitalism do its work. But the truth is that all really successful capitalist enterprises have tremendous state intervention and tremendous state support. And this is just one example of Amazon receiving huge state support and intervention so that it can save potentially millions, maybe billions of dollars on energy.
Yeah, it's really important point. And Amazon is taking over everything, or seems to be. And people always think, oh, okay, well, look, with volume, with quantity, we'll get lower prices. You know, Amazon is, okay, they're driving out small businesses, they're driving out retail because of online shopping, it's more convenient, they undersell the competition. There are advantages to the consumer, that's why people are shopping with them. But what we're actually witnessing is that as Amazon conquers every piece or almost every piece of the market that it enters, and it's entering all these different markets, what it basically gives Amazon is undiluted authority. And by undiluted authority, I mean monopoly. So you can't really have monopoly, which is the end of competition and really the end of choice, and then at the same time say, oh, but this is democratic. Monopoly is the antithesis of democratic. And here you have a private corporation with very, very, very rich people. Bezos is the richest man in the world. He made, I don't know, $19 billion more last month than he had the month before. And they have undiluted authority, which means they can do whatever they want. And whatever they want is to maximize their profit, which is at the expense of all others, either consumers eventually, certainly smaller businesses, which are being driven out. If the middle class wants to complain, the middle class's anger is largely directed against poor people, as if the declining fortunes of the middle class, say small business owners, is because of immigrants or, you know, poor people are getting too much from the federal government. But it's really monopoly corporations that are doing in the middle class small businessman.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important, too, when we talk about monopoly power, is you don't even need to really own the things you're monopolizing. So in this case, Amazon doesn't, you know, own power plants. They don't own the fiber optics or the cables or whatever that move data or energy around that they use. Those are owned by other private companies and sometimes states as well. But they effectively own it and determine its future because they have that outsized influence, because they are the buyer of choice. There's no other buyers to compete with them that can, you know, offer the same size of purchasing power. And so that allows them a monopoly control without even really having to own or build anything. You know, the article goes on to talk about certain states that use tax dollars to build new power lines for these data centers, you know, free for Amazon. So Amazon doesn't have to pay for the expense of building these power lines, their upkeep, any of that. It's all owned by the state, but the state will do it for them because of the outsized control they have. And that can, you know, apply to a lot of other different sectors as well. I mean, I think of, you know, as Amazon moves more and more into software and such, imagine all the hardware manufacturers will start designing specs specifically for Amazon because they want that business. They want that big company. You know, there's many ways we can apply it to it. And yeah, I agree. The you know, working class don't have an outlet. You know, Amazon wants to take its billion-dollar business to another state, then it does it. I don't have a whole lot of options when it comes to utilities and power. I can't just walk away. I mean, I've said it before, but Comcast is the only internet service provider in my neighborhood, so I can use Comcast or I cannot use the internet. Amazon doesn't have that limitation, and that's a significant difference, and that's part of that outsized monopoly control.
Time magazine did a report about Amazon workers and what they make. I want to read a little something from it. Oh, it's something I actually wrote about the Time magazine. The median Amazon employee salary is $28,466. Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon and the Washington Post, made more than that every 8.93 seconds so far in 2018. His net wealth increased by $33 billion in the first 5 months of 2018. $33 billion. I had said $19 billion.
That's the increase in his wealth.
That's the increase. And then I wrote, capitalism is not a, quote, free market, close quote, whatever that even means. It is a system of plunder and looting by a class of super rich people whose personal wealth exceeds the kings and queens and other tyrants throughout all of human history. You can see I was ranting. I was on Facebook and I was like,
I shared that.
8.93 seconds. That's what the average Amazon worker, that's how long it takes Jeff Bezos to make what the average Amazon worker makes in a year.
And that Time magazine article added that most Amazon workers are not even permitted to have a bathroom break. And in some of the big warehouses, people actually bring receptacles with them to work that they can urinate in because they're not permitted to leave their stations.
Yeah. And so when people think about, hey, we're in the middle of an economic recovery, I'm just looking at the Wall Street Journal, the bull market has entered its longest streak, meaning the bulls are running, it's going great, the stock market is booming. But if you're an Amazon employee, and you know what, most of the working class in America is going to be ending up as warehouse workers or, you know, in these kind of positions, $28,000 a year. Now, for a family of four, and this is ridiculous too, the poverty level, the official poverty level, is $24,000. So if you're in poverty, you're entitled to all kinds of things, food stamps, other sort of entitlement programs, although the government's trying to whittle away. So Amazon exploits the hell out of its workers. doesn't pay them anything. Jeff Bezos makes $33 billion more than he had before January 1st, 2018, in the first 5 months of 2018. And then we, the taxpayers, will have to pay for the impoverished Amazon workers' benefits because Jeff Bezos, guess what, doesn't want to. He doesn't want to give them a living wage.
Exactly. Talk about state intervention when all of a sudden, you know, you get taxpayers to pay for your employees, you know, poverty, essentially, because you refuse to give them anything above poverty wages. I also like to point out that, you know, the poverty level, who sets the poverty level? Who determines what the poverty level is? Well, government agencies do at the federal level, and they are largely run at the top by multimillionaires. So multimillionaires in Congress determine whether you're poor or not, which is ridiculous. $28,000 a year. I mean, literally, you cannot live on that in the Bay Area. You would be homeless. There's literally no places you could stay or live in on that amount of money. I can't imagine what that's like anywhere else, but any sort of major urban center, that's impossible. And yet, when we talk about, you know, Jeff Bezos making, you know, the same amount of money almost every 9 seconds, we need to connect the two, because that's why he can make that much money every 9 seconds, is because someone else is making $28,000 a year.
Yeah, that's
why. It's taking them a year to accumulate. Exactly. There's a very clear causal connection between those things. If those people were making a living wage and making money that they could support, say, a family of four, Jeff Bezos wouldn't be able to make that much
money.
Maybe
he would have only
made
$1 billion more in the first 5 months instead of $33 billion if they had a living wage.
Exactly. And that's the thing, right? That's not even much of a cutback. That's not going to materially change Jeff's life at all.
No, he wouldn't even miss it. And then in the meantime, if he did something like that, he would be seen around the world as a corporate savior to his people, to his employees.
But I'll tell you who wouldn't think that is his board of investors. They
absolutely
would be
right.
Furious, and he would be thrown out very quickly.
Yep, you're absolutely right.
So that is who's making the difference. I don't know the size of his board, but say 10, 15 people are determining that, yeah, $28,000 starvation wages, peeing in buckets on assembly lines, this all makes sense so that we can make, you know, $28,000 every 9 seconds or so. And I think it's worth pointing out, you know, someone said Jeff Bezos is the wealthiest man in the world, which is accurate. But actually, you know, other studies have shown he's probably the wealthiest man in human history. It's always hard to rate these things, you know, how rich really was Alexander the Great, you know, adjusted for price of inflation and all that. But I don't think that's that unusual, ridiculous of a thing to say. I think that's probably accurate. He is probably the wealthiest human being in human history. And just like Brian was saying, the kings whose serfs were worked to death in the field and not allowed to attend to basic needs were the reason why the king was so rich and had all this gold piled around him. And the same thing is for Jeff. People peeing in buckets along assembly line is the reason why Jeff Bezos gets to, you know, live and be the type of individual that he is.
I'm looking at now that we're talking about poverty and Amazon workers, I'm looking at the 2018 poverty guidelines right now. These are amazing statistics. This is what the government says you have to be making or not making in order to be poor. This is for the 48 contiguous states, that's the mainland, and the District of Columbia. If you are a single person and you are making $12,141, you are not officially poor if you are a single person. If you have, let's say, a mom and one child, if she is making more than $16,461, she is not in poverty. $16,000. I mean, in Washington, D.C.,
it's an outrage.
You cannot rent an apartment for under $1,000. That doesn't exist. If you have four people in your house, let's say you're two parents and two children, and if you make more than $25,101, you're not in poverty. Now, this is obviously ludicrous. The real poverty rate has to be double that. If you're a single person and you're making $24,000 in Washington, D.C., or most urban areas, you're way poor, and that's double the official poverty line. So these statistics about how many people are poor in America are just unreal.
Yeah, I would love to hear input from the people who live at those levels of poverty or above them. Why don't we go to them for their data sources and ask them, do you feel poor? What is poverty like for you? How about what sort of rating would you have? And really, it's just about these state agencies lowering the standard of living and justifying not paying out benefits to people who so desperately need it because they're, quotes, not poor. I mean, you cited for a single person, $12,000 and some odd dollars a year was considered, you know, not in poverty, you know, rounded up to $13,000. That's like $1,083 a month to live on if you were making $13,000 a year. And you know what rent costs even in terrible neighborhoods. That is impossible to live on. You can't eat food and live in a home on that type of salary, which is to say that you cannot live on that type of salary. And yet, you know, if you make $13,000 a year and you're a single person, apparently, according to some state agency, you're doing okay. You're not in poverty and you don't need food stamps. You know, this is ludicrous. This is the same reason why all these different newspapers and agencies are trumpeting about the employment rate is so unemployment rate is so low. It's fantastic. But this is what employment counts for, right? This is $13,000 a year. This is peeing in buckets and lines of Amazon where you're making nothing. This is not being able to afford rent or food and having to make a judgment call over whether you eat ramen packets or not. And this is something we should be excited about because the New York Times says the unemployment rate is so low and that the bull market has just gone on to its, you know, longest run ever. And I think we need, again, like I said before, to connect those two together. The bull market has gone on for so long, which is to say that corporations have been consistently making money for so long because poverty rates are out of control, because benefits are so rarely paid out, and because these people are being forced to making a decision to whether I should eat today or pay rent. That's why the bull market is going on so long. We should be frightened of these huge economic increases, these huge economic expansions, because it means that corporations are taking so much more than they did the last time and will continue to take more as much as they possibly can.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel's a financial policy analyst. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday here on Loud and Clear. The segment is called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel, let's move on. We have about 10 minutes left in our segment. Let's move on to a couple other stories. John and I had spoken, I believe yesterday, John, about the official bailout for Greece ending.
Yes.
And, you know, all over the EU was congratulating itself. Look, we've successfully bailed out the Greek economy. Then I'm looking at media stories today. All of these Greek workers, I mean, middle-aged men, there's a guy who's featured in the Wall Street Journal. He's living on, you know, his parents' pension. He's like 45, 50 years old.
Sure.
He can't work. He's not going to ever work
again.
And
that's the norm. That's the norm in Greece. I got back from Greece day before yesterday, and I mentioned this on the show yesterday. I'm going to elaborate on it a little bit if you don't mind. I saw things that I've never seen in Greece before. I saw Greeks going through garbage cans looking for food. Greeks don't beg. They're too proud to beg. But what they do is they'll go on to the subway and try to sell pens or tissues. They won't ask for a freebie, but they're trying to sell a pen. There was one young man that I saw. He came onto the subway car. He said in Greek that he had been a journalist with the socialist newspaper Eleftherotypia. It was one of the major newspapers in Greece, and it went belly up during the early couple of years of the economic crisis. He was holding pens in one hand that he was trying to sell, and holding his ID from the newspaper, his old ID card, to prove that he really was a journalist, and he was. And he said that he has a 2-year-old, and the 2-year-old needs to eat. This is how bad it is. This is how bad it's become in Greece that people can't even provide for their children anymore. I have a very close friend who I traveled with last week, and she lives, she's 30 years old, almost 31 years old, and she lives with her parents. Every 30 and 40 year old I know in Greece lives with their parents, because when the average salary is 400 euros a month, and that's what it is, and I'm talking about for educated people, people with bachelor's and master's degrees. My friend has a master's degree in law. But you still have to live with your parents because you just simply can't make it.
Yeah, and Daniel, let's look at this. There wasn't a war that took Greece down. There wasn't like a natural disaster, an act of God, so to speak. This was peacetime. And suddenly, Greece and the Greek people plunged into this massive immiseration. And again, it's completely, well, I would say man-made, but it's really the byproduct of a social economic order in Europe and elsewhere, whereby a country, meaning all of its people, who have not been victimized by war or victimized by natural disaster and who have actually done nothing wrong.
No.
They didn't do, there wasn't anything that the Greek, the individual Greek person in mass did that would suddenly lower their living standard like this. So let's just talk about it. Why? Why? Why did this happen?
Well, really, it all started here in the United States. When the 2008 crisis occurred, it rippled outwards and it affected the global economy. This is the heart of capitalism in the United States. And when it started to fail here and collapse, it naturally started to collapse all over the world. Europe was hit extremely hard by the 2008 crisis and by the downstream effect. The contraction of the economy, the contraction of buying, the contraction of credit, and all of that really hurt Europe. And Europe is still reeling from it. I mean, Brexit is a downstream effect of the 2008 crisis. Honestly, there would have been a Grexit if Greece had more money. Really, the only reason that the UK is able to start affecting this is because it has a lot more financialization and a lot more wealth versus Greece. Greece wasn't able to affect that. And so what happened? Well, this austerity policy was put in place. And really, the austerity policy is this idea that, oh, you borrowed too much money. You've lived high on the hog and extravagantly because you wanted, such insane luxuries as, an automobile or decent clothing or things like that. You've gone too far and now you have to pay it all back and now you're all poor. And, it's used these very general terms as if Greece is a monolith. Well, wealthy Greek politicians did take out way too many loans and did overburden the state with debt. But it wasn't the Greek people that were necessarily doing it. And I'm sure they were heavily incentivized to take out these loans. They were told it was safe, that it was fine. Don't worry about it. You'll make a lot of money. You'll stimulate your economy. And then, of course, oops, that didn't happen. We ran out of money. And now the bank needs everything. And the bank, used it as an excuse to privatize huge parts of the Greek economy and society, buying up public sector things like airports and shipping ports and things like that. Of course, Greece has, had a good economy in the shipping industry. And so privatized a lot of those ports, forcing the state to sell off these different things. And the whole austerity thing was sold under the idea that, yeah, it'd be unpleasant, but once you come out of it, your economy will be back on track and you'll be okay. And that's not true, right? We just completed the austerity measure. We have an objective example of what happens, and what we have is rampant poverty, unemployment, and Greeks that feel like they have no future. So really the purpose of austerity was not to do that. The purpose of austerity was not to help these people and was not to make their country better. The purpose was austerity was imposed by bankers, central banks, other state agencies that are essentially in the pocket of the very wealthy in Europe, so that they could privatize and kind of dismember Greece as much as possible now that it was weak and starting to fall apart. And that's exactly what they did. And they made a tremendous amount of money getting these state assets for pennies on the dollar because the economy was collapsing and Greece was desperate, that was the point of the austerity movement. That was the point, was to increase and speed up privatization in a country that had a reasonably good state sector, reasonably good employment, and to essentially immiserate the people there for purposes of making profit. And that's the final results. It's what we see at the end of austerity. It's been very effective at making some rich people very rich and very ineffective at making anything better for Greece.
One of the things that surprised me on this trip too is the Ministry of Information is on one of the main roads, and I always stay in that neighborhood just because it's so well located. And I go to the Ministry of Education because there's an ancient Byzantine church that sits immediately underneath it. The ministry is built over the top of this old church, and I like to take pictures of it. Well, I went this time, and it's no longer the Ministry of Education. It's now a luxury hotel, and it's because the government is so utterly broke that they've begun selling off their ministry buildings and then doubling up. So the Ministry of Education has moved in with the Ministry of Merchant Marine. And then the Ministry of Youth has moved in with the Ministry of Infrastructure, for example. It's shrinking. The public sector is shrinking. Nobody's making any money. Unemployment is still over 20%. Unemployment for young people is still over 35%. The Greek stock market is dead. The banks can celebrate and say how successful they were and how great this is because they're going to get their money back. But the Greek people are still suffering just as much as they've suffered over the last 8 years.
Daniel, you know, when John describes this, and as you've described it, you can't help but think to the colonial era. I mean, the British did this to India. The Dutch did this to Indonesia. The French did this to Syria and to Lebanon. The British did this to Iraq and to Egypt. It's a kind of a we no longer live formally in the era of colonialism, although that's not true, say, for Puerto Rico. But this is a kind of financial colonialism that's almost as powerful, perhaps more powerful.
Yeah, it is perhaps more powerful because you at least have the illusion of independence, right? Back in the old colonial days, you were an annex of the crown of whatever country, you know, happened to colonize you. And now there can be the illusion that, oh, no, you're your own independent state, you're your own nation. But the truth is that these economic ties are even far more powerful and influential than military ties where you're occupying a country, you know, at gunpoint and taking what you want from it. These economic ties, you know, force Greece to make this decision between accepting a bailout, which immiserates its people and causes, you know, all these old state buildings to now become luxury hotels for pennies on the dollar, or you can go bankrupt, right? You can become insolvent, and that will immiserate everyone as well as your currency becomes, you know, valueless and your whole economy starts collapsing. This was, you know, that was the gunpoint. And to say that somehow that that's different or better than the literal gunpoint of the old colonial days is, you know, complete misnomer. It is extremely powerful. And the United States wields this economic power throughout the world. And when it has its 2008 crises or its crashes or whatever, the rest of the world has to pick up the pieces. The rest of the world has to kind of put it together and try to survive. And Greece is, you know, struggling to do that now. You know, whether it's sanctions that we place on other countries that cripple their economies or tariffs that cause other countries' whole sectors to fall apart or these austerity measures, that's the sort of power that is wielded today. And it really is a modern day kind of neo-colonialism. And, you know, even a country like Greece, solidly in the West, solidly part of the European Union, not, you know, vilified in U.S. discourse, can fall prey to it. And we'll absolutely let these countries,
yeah,
you know,
it
fall
was,
prey to these things.
If it was Venezuela and the U.S. and the CIA wanted to topple mm-hmm. the government, they would go at it just as they are in Venezuela. But
that's
you're right.
Right.
Because Greece is, quote, an ally, even though it's being treated as like the way you would treat your worst enemy. The government may not fall because the U.S. doesn't want it to fall, but nonetheless, the people are paying this terrible, terrible price. Anyway, we are out of time. Another great segment. We talk every Tuesday with Daniel Sankey in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.